Grape Minds, the wine-centric podcast that looks beyond the glass to the much more interesting world of the people, history, and culture that make it happen. I'm Julie Glenn.
And I'm Gina Birch, and today I'm really excited because we're going to go to one of my favorite wine regions in the world, Oregon. I just love the wines there. I love the Pinot Noir. It just takes me to another place sometimes when I'm drinking a good Willamette Pinot Noir. And we've got one of the pioneers of the Oregon wine industry, Lang Estate Winery and Vineyard, in studio with us this morning, Jesse Lang. Jesse, thanks for coming all the way from Oregon just to see us this morning. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So tell us a little bit. I mean, I could sit here and read your bio to everybody who's listening, but tell me a little bit about you, who you are within the family and in the winery, and go.
So, yeah, I'm fortunate enough to be a second-generation wine grower and winemaker in the Willamette Valley. My family moved to the Dundee Hills in 1987 as one of the pioneering families in the valley, and looking to make world-class varietals before there was even such a thing as an Oregon wine industry. Mm-hmm. So we kind of helped develop that, and it's been a fun 32-year ride, and being able to sit here with you in Florida is kind of a paradigm shift from where it was back in 1987 and even before that.
So I have a question as a second-generation person in the family business. Did you just know always that, well, this is just my destiny? Or was there a time where you had that rebellious, like, Mom and Dad, I'm going to go off to Canada or go surf in somewhere?
I'm going to go be a rock star.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
a doctor.
Did you or radio
that?
Star.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Well, radio star is also very glamorous.
Did you have that moment?
No. I think, like, some of those expectations are maybe for regions that are maybe more well-established than the Willamette Valley was during my kind of growing up period. Because I think when we started, there wasn't any guarantees that our region was going to have anywhere near the kind of acclaim worldwide that we enjoy today. So it was kind of grinding it out day by day. I mean, we had
I need to have a fallback position. You know,
Like, well, you know, baseball wasn't going to work out, and couldn't hit a curveball, and basketball is too short, and, you know, all kind of hosts of different things. So I think for me, really, when I decided that this was going to be my path for a career, I'd grown up, you know, farming wine grapes and working with my dad in the cellar and helping around the farm a fair bit. But when I really felt like I wanted to make this a career and that my life professional goals were going to encompass making world-class wines was when I went to New Zealand to study wine in 1999 on a scholarship from Oregon State University. I attended Lincoln University in Christchurch in New Zealand, the South Island, and that sort of cemented my passion for growing grapes and really delving into the deeper layers of our community, our region, and the wines.
Right. Beautiful place to go learn wine, right?
Yeah, no kidding. You weren't tempted to bring any back any Sauvignon Blanc up to
I drank enough, yeah. In spirit, I brought a lot back.
So you alluded to it before, but your family started this winery before most people even saw the potential of Oregon as a wine growing state. What were they thinking?
Well, you had to be a little Bart crazy to make it happen. My folks were making wine in Santa Barbara County. My father, Don, my mother, Wendy Lang, teaching on the side. My dad's got an MFA from the Writers' Workshop, University of Iowa. They were teaching at UC Santa Barbara, City College there. My dad was working at a number of different wineries around Santa Barbara County when that industry was in its kind of infancy as well. And they fell in love with Pinot Noir. It's kind of their favorite varietal. Love kind of the complexity it can achieve and sort of its food versatility. And that was kind of the grail was Pinot Noir. And they had some wines from the Willamette Valley, most notably from Dick Erath from Erath Vineyards, and then David Lett, who pioneered our industry post-Prohibition, from the Irie Vineyards. And those Pinot Noirs had the most in common on the West Coast with sort of traditional Burgundian wines from Côte de Nuits and Côte de Beaune. And I think that those two wines really were enough of an impetus to reach out and start really taking another hard look at the Willamette Valley because the truth was in the wine, you know, in Vino Veritas to some degree. And they felt like the wines really spoke of world-class place to be. And like my dad always says, it's like, growing the right grape in the right place, there's no substitute for it. Mm. And they really felt that that was going to be the place to be in the new world.
I always felt like people looked at the globe and looked at the, what is it?
Latitude
line of where Burgundy is, and this kind of drew a little line all the way around and figured, oh, that's pretty much
yeah,
matches
let's stop
up.
Here. Yeah.
I never understood why people didn't do that earlier, but, you know, so they went for it. But it's not just Pinot Noir up there.
Not at all. We pioneered Pinot Gris domestically. Mm-hmm. The first 12 producers of Pinot Gris in North America were all from the Willamette Valley.
I would like to thank you for that. Yes, me too.
We were the fourth, so we'll take the fourth place.
I love me some Pinot Gris. I'm not throwing that away.
It's a wonderful grape. I mean, I think it was 1989, my family was producing more Pinot Gris than any winery here in the United States. And that was only like 900 cases, much at all.
So when the family first got started, was there a lot of trial and error to get to the signature, your flagship brands, or did it kind of come fairly simple?
No. It was, there's some great stories from even the earlier pioneers that preceded us, like the Ponzi's, the Letts at Eras, the Campbell, Sokol Blossers. I mean, they were planting Riesling, pulling out Pinot Noir. I mean, there was definitely a lot of trial and error in the early days, and nobody knew what we were going to be able to hang our hat on as the varietal that kind of carried the region. We kept pushing Pinot Noir and kept working on Pinot Noir and honing our craft and honing our farming and honing our craft and honing the farming. And that kind of repetitive, you know, opportunity that you get once a year to do that, really, and the trial and error and sort of the incremental progression towards, you know, world-class wines was something we were chipping away at. And I don't know when we sort of achieved that, if you will, because you never rest when you're trying to make something that's unattainable. If you're really trying to make the best wines in the world and the best that you can make, and that's sort of a never-ending goal. So I don't know when that switch flipped, but it did. And, you know, Pinot Gris was a part of that, to be sure. I mean, the hottest varietal now in the Willamette Valley that people don't stop talking about is Chardonnay, which is great because that's my favorite.
It is also
varietal.
So good.
Oh, I mean, we're making
Oregon Chardonnay. Yes.
Yeah, we're making some. I mean, the last like maybe decade, I think my Chardonnays have reached a level that's pretty world class.
I heard a lot about incorrect clones being planted in the first few go arounds.
Sure.
And did that impact you all?
Definitely. Yeah. I think the clonal material that Oregon State, my alma mater, so go Beavs, they brought in, and David Adelsheim from Adelsheim Vineyard was part of that. But through the USDA, they brought in a whole host of new clones for Chardonnay and Pinot Noir varietals. All that clonal material came in the early 90s and started to get planted throughout the Willamette Valley. And as much as it did great things for the sort of complexity potential of Pinot Noir, just from the viticulture side, I think it had even a grander impact for Chardonnay. And we started getting some of those Dijon Chardonnay clones in, like 95, 96, and 76 clones.
So a Chardonnay is not a Chardonnay. I mean, not every Chardonnay vine is the same. There are different clones?
Yeah, there's different mutations. Grapevines are pretty genetically unstable when you're planting 1,500 or 1,000 plants per acre. And if you're paying attention enough to notice any physiological differences, you can actually take scion cuttings and plant those, propagate them, and you'll have an actual different clone of the varietal that you have. So
The Pinot family is apparently like really notorious for
it. Is
its,
yeah,
it's just mutations and mutations.
Pinot Gris, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Meunier, all those are scions of Pinot Noir.
Now, so there was an article. I'm sorry. There was an article in the Seattle Times about Pinot Pierre. It's a new spontaneous mutation of Pinot that occurred in the vineyard that's called Winter's Hill. It was noticed by your dad, Don Lang.
Yeah.
Tell me about that grape and when that showed up. What's that about?
We noticed that in the vineyard at Peter Gladhart. So he's the Pierre of Pinot Pierre. And the Gladhart vineyard at Winter's Hill there, we were walking around and my pops noticed a different sort of color to this Pinot Noir vine. And it was kind of green and yellow, and tasted it. And sure enough, the grapes tasted different from anything else we had seen, and certainly wasn't Pinot Noir. So that was a great opportunity to take a look at getting some wood. We made some cuttings. We propagated that. We planted about an acre on our property. And it's been 15 years of making Pierre, which we call Indigenais for indigenous because it's indigenous to the Dundee Hills.
Because you haven't been able to get it legally named a grape yet, correct?
I don't think we've tried. It's one of my father's projects. So.
Right.
But it certainly makes compelling wine. And I think like at the end of the day, it's somewhere in between like an Albarino or a Gruner Veltliner. Mm. And it's got great minerality, amazing kind of fruit complexity. But it has Pinot Noir texture on the palate too, so.
Wow. Okay. So now is that available? Is that distributed or is that?
No, we only have like.
Can I get that right now?
I want some now.
Yeah, our website has it. Okay. We don't have that in distribution. We only make about 100 cases annually. So it's It's uber small production.
Do we have to join the wine club to get it or to visit you in person?
The answer to
it?
The wine club is always yes. Yes. You have to join.
Cha-ching!
Exactly.
So how much is distributed in Florida? How many of the different
We've been with Breakthrough Beverage Cheers, our wholesaler in the state of Florida, for the better part of 2 decades. Our broker, Brad Kinder from Kind Wines, is based in Miami, and he used to work for what was then Premier and now Breakthrough. And so he knows our family exceedingly well, knows the vines, knows the land, and knows the story really well, and knows the wines. So he's been a great catalyst, along with Breakthrough, to promote our wines here in the state. We have Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, and a host of different Pinot Noirs that are available here.
Okay.
And then what things are just available direct from the website?
Well, I make like almost 20 different bottlings of Pinot Noir annually. So
a lot of single vineyards?
That stuff gets out of control. And yeah. It's really fun because as a varietal, Pinot Noir is so compelling in the way that it can achieve certain profiles that showcase a sense of place. And I do a number of single vineyard bottlings from Freedom Hill, Temperance Hill, our estate. I do some elevation bottlings that are really compelling. And I do clonal bottlings. And then I do one that is kind of a geology tramp through the Willamette Valley where I focus on the soil types. So I do a volcanic, a marine sedimentary, and a windblown soil type bottling that compare and contrast between the wines, because that's one of the beautiful things about Pinot Noir. You can have simultaneously really great wines, but it's the difference that makes them really compelling.
So if someone's looking for Pinot Pierre, it's under a different label. It's called Domaine Trouvert.
Yeah, Trouvert is our sister label to Lang Estate Winery, and it's a project we started in 2005, which is to focus on some varietals that aren't that are Northwest varietals that aren't readily grown in the Willamette Valley, because the Northwest is a pretty big geographical area. There's lots of different AVAs and growing areas. So we did a little Sangiovese, Tempranillo from Southern Oregon, Syrah from Southern Oregon.
Wow.
And Viognier from even further south.
So is that the only second labels or sister label that you have?
And it's pretty small production. It's a couple thousand cases. But I think that to temper that natural inclination as winemakers and that creative aspect of what we do is hard to temper sometimes. So as general manager as well, I have to dial some of that back and have some self-discipline at times.
No kidding.
Self-discipline, what is that?
They are fun projects, to be sure.
So the second labels, are they kind of a place to have fun and really just kind of experiment?
Yeah, I think so. And learn different techniques and different varietals. And I think you don't want to get cellar palate as a winemaker, especially if you've grown up in something and done it for so long. You need to continue to push your boundaries out. And not just your like cerebral boundaries, but your palate boundaries. So I try to drink a lot of different wines from different regions in the world. I try to travel a fair bit and ask a lot of questions. There's just no substitute for being there. And that, I think, affords me an opportunity to keep my periphery really pushed wide. And that allows me, I think, to be a better winemaker.
So what would cellar palate be? Cellar palate's where you just kind of just...
You kind of taste your own wines and you sort of get, I think, in a comfortable lane where you're not... maybe not as critical as you would be otherwise. And having a critical palate is really important. I mean, it's funny because like people ask me quite a bit, even at a tasting we did last night, like, what do you like about this wine? What do you like about this wine? I'm like, well, why don't you try it first? But
right. It
was for me, when I go step into a wine, figuratively speaking, and I taste the wine and smell it, I'm always looking for what's wrong with it first. Mm. And that's sort of that critical analysis. I kind of get to what I like later in the process, but my job is really to be critical about wine.
It's kind of like a scientist.
Yeah.
You know, they're always looking to disprove before they'll just accept
something
as it is.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy. Absolutely.
You have this great array of Pinot Noirs. What is it? Are there some very specific characteristics that set them apart from other Pinot Noirs in the world and maybe even in Willamette?
Yeah, I think the bright fruit aspect of the Willamette Valley is something that's really important. We are able to achieve physiological ripeness but retain really nice acidity in the wine. And I think acidity is that life force of any given wine. It brings that backbone. It's that scaffolding in which all the other components hang. And we have great natural vibrancy in the wines in the Willamette Valley because we have really warm days in the summer and very cool nights. And that diurnal temperature shifts allow you to achieve flavor development, but then you're able to retain nice acidity. And so it's that freshness of fruit characteristics. I think there's a lot of red and blue fruits that you can get in the Willamette Valley, depending on where you are. Some of that can be soil type driven, clone driven, elevation driven, aspect, all those different viticultural criteria. And I think just sort of like the food compatibility with Willamette Valley wines is really amazing. You know, the wines have traditionally really great balance, and it's great to see Pinot Noir sort of evolve to this place that people are drinking so much Pinot Noir now.
Do you feel like the market's kind of going that direction, though, with people are starting to see wine as a food group, as something that's supposed to, not necessarily food, but I do. I always have. Yeah. I mean, but where they're starting to see wine as something not to just always be sipping by itself, but something that's part of the dining, because now people are getting more and more foodie. And
oh, definitely. Yeah, we have a food channel. What's that?
Right.
Even, you know,
When I grew up,
yeah, it was just such a different component. I mean, there's so many different food channels. There's like celebrity chefs. Like, what the heck is that? I mean, my uncle's a chef. You didn't want him in the front of the house, in front of the TV.
No kidding.
His job was to make your food, not stand in the dining room. And, you know, it's, I mean, even winemakers now have this degree of celebrity that's just sort of weird. I don't really know how to explain it. I mean, I'm certainly not one of them, but you see some of my colleagues that are on TV all the time, and it's just odd. I don't know.
It's like, it is weird.
If you're busy being a celebrity, you're probably not practicing your craft. And I think that difference, you have to grind, and that's how world class wines come about. Are the people that are in the vineyards making decisions, that are in the cellar making decisions,
day in day out,
day in and day out.
Except when you're in Florida on.
I have a great team at home too. I did take a red eye to get here, so I keep them pretty short.
I believe you. So we were talking about some of the changes. You know, now we have chefs out in front of the house that have scrubbed themselves off and are using words that are safe for work, right?
Fancy hair and everything.
Yeah. But one of the other things that have changed, I think, since your family first got up into Oregon and started doing wine has been the climate. Have you noticed an impact on warming weather where you're at?
Yeah, I think we have across the globe. The Willamette Valley isn't any different in that regard. I don't think we're anywhere near like passing that threshold of growing the varietals that we like to grow there.
Like you're going to start having Zinfandel grown?
Yeah, that's not going to happen anytime soon. I mean, there's so many other regions in this country that would have that conversation a few decades before us. But yeah, I think in general, like our seasons are a little bit earlier, a little bit warmer. You know, but climate change can affect your winters too in terms of the precipitation, snowfall, and ice and stuff.
Hailstorms,
So we had, you know, we had a fair bit of snow and ice last winter, but this winter has been pretty dry and warm. So, yeah, I think it's something that I'm attuned to being a farmer. And we've had, this will be our 32nd vintage coming up here in the Willamette Valley. So you have a pretty big sample size. And yeah, I think definitely things are trending in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Great. All right.
So let's wrap things up with some rapid fire questions. We like to do this every once in a while just because it's fun.
Just because I'm here.
All right. Yeah, yes.
So don't even think about it. Just throw out what comes to mind.
That's always good when you're being taped. Don't think
about
it.
There are only a couple.
Yeah, that's what we like to do. Okay, first tell me your favorite grape.
Pinot Noir.
Of course.
Okay, I kind of saw that coming.
First time you fell in love with wine.
Ooh, I was probably too young to answer that question. I don't know if there was one specific instance where I fell in love with wine.
I know, that's tough for him because you kind of grew up with it in your bottle,
didn't
you?
Yeah, it's kind of in my blood.
Yeah. The statute of limitation on DCF is kind of over, so your parents are not in danger of getting
into it. Yeah.
What is your favorite kind of music?
Wow. I kind of like all different kinds. I like variety, just like my wines. I don't think I have a favorite type of music.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's sellout.
That's
answer,
okay.
But
you know, because the creative people sometimes have, I got to have classical when I'm doing this, or country. All right. So, favorite thing to drink when you're not drinking wine?
Ooh. I don't drink a lot of spirits. I like beer.
Okay.
But like low octane stuff, like Pilsners and something light and refreshing, that, you know, Stella Artois, something like
that. There you go. Nice.
Good for this climate.
Yeah, I agree.
Exactly.
In the tropics, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming in. Jesse Lang with Lang Estate Winery and Vineyards. It's been so great talking with you.
Yeah, thank you.
Wonderful to be here.
Thank
you, ladies.
Can't wait to drink some more of your wine.
I know. Let's crack a bottle. Let's pull some corks.
Order some of that weird Pierre.
En Dijonais.
Yeah. I can't wait. That sounds so intriguing. Grape Minds is produced at WGCU Studios on FGCU campus in Fort Myers, Florida. Our producers for online media are Anna Bejarano and Tara Callaghan. Technical production is by Mike Canary.
Grape Minds theme music, Frizzante, by Colin Mannon. To get in touch, check grapeminds.org. Thanks for listening.